Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, February 24th, and we got a good show for you today. Joining me, my name is Magnus Tiewald. I'm one of your hosts for today. Joining me in the studio today is
Peter R.H.
and
Liam McCarrigario.
And we're going to start off talking a bit about some of the current events. It is, we'll get to that in a second, but we're going to... Then we're going to head over to a report on a new art exhibition. Our correspondent Stephen Fan was here a couple weeks ago talking about this show. And Jesse Wentzloff, our reporter here, has a more expanded report on that. It's from the artist Kilyada Christian White, an exhibition at the...
Bill Reed Gallery.
Thank you. I totally drew a blank on that for a second, at the Bill Reed Gallery. Yeah. We also have a report from our colleagues up in Prince George about job fraud. That is sort of scams that hope to lure you in thinking you're going to get a job, and next thing you know, you're out of a lot of money. And some more great stuff, including Peter's going to talk about aluminum.
One of the things... Because the tariffs... or 25% on all for the United States, so aluminum and steel. But there's a lot to... the United States only makes 50% of their own aluminum. 30% comes from Canada. And I'll elaborate further on this.
Excellent. So in terms of what's going on in the world, you know, it's hard to know even where to start. The last time we were on the air was 2 weeks ago. And we were on the air last week, but we weren't live because the building here was closed. Let's see. We've been lots more news on tariffs, and we're waiting till next week to see what happens with the threatened tariffs. We've had enormous developments on the situation with Ukraine, and larger than that, the whole sort of transatlantic relationship between the United States and Europe, which includes Canada, in that broader relationship. We've had all sorts of developments down in the States with the fairly large-scale firings of federal employees and Elon Musk's DOGE, or Department of Government Efficiency, gaining access to substantial amounts of... government records, which has a lot of people concerned, more executive orders they come so fast that it's hard to know, it's hard to keep up with them all. Mm-hmm. But ones that apparently sort of declare that the president is basically the only arbiter of the law, which sort of goes against the Constitution. And then there's the whole craziness that Gaza scheme and everything else. And of course, the sort of continued sort of disrespect of from the president towards Canada and sort of verbal threats against our sovereignty. Anything that sticks out as the biggest thing for you guys?
Well, one thing about the last thing you brought up, when are we going to go to international law about this? I mean, really, or bring it up to the United Nations in some point?
Because, I don't know, which part of it.
Well, all of it. It's interesting that the Secretary of Commerce wasn't sworn in until about like a week ago or so.
Yeah.
And I have here, and his name is Harold Lutnick. But here on from my tablet, it says here, this I got from the internet, the Secretary Commerce strives to increase job opportunities and represent U.S. businesses with the president's cabinet, as well as fulfill other duties to drive economic development and growth. Now, I saw, because I've been going through a lot of things I see in like very incidental things. I finally saw something where prior to Howard Lutnick being sworn in as Secretary of Commerce, Donald Trump was making a few statements. And then he said to the press, oh, well, I'm going to have Howard say a few things. Now, Howard Lutnick at that point, not yet sworn in, said that a report was going to be done that was going to be ready by April 1st for them to act upon on April 2nd. Now, it could well be that I went through it a few times. It was a very short little thing what Harold Lutnick said. This could just be concerning counter tariffs, but the thing is, if this is concerning tariffs in general, then there's another goal post April 1st or April 2nd. So it could well be that it's about the counter tariffs that we'll put in. It's interesting that a lot of all this rhetoric from Donald Trump was done before there was a Secretary of Commerce. And I just read from there that briefly what supposedly the person is. Now, there's about 3 hours of, you know, when you have a post like that, all the senators ask him questions. And I didn't go through the whole thing, but one of the senators said, well, he even brought up the fact about the auto parts. They go back and forth. And then Howard Lutnick said something like, oh, well, he's just doing that to get more security at the border in Canada. So the thing is, if he is going to back up these tariffs, he's basically disingenuous about something he said at either the House of Representatives or the Senate, actually. Right. So it is the problem is Trump, he has a history of dealing with jurisprudence as opposed to law itself. Like when he was doing his developments, he wouldn't pay people, the contractor, to last third. When people do building contracts, my understanding, someone told me you pay the first allotment, the middle, and the end. So he only paid two-thirds of what people were due again and again because the jurisprudence was impossible for them. And this is what Trump deals with.
Right. So I want to jump over to Liam, because you had something you were going to raise.
Yeah, just kind of build off your points. I feel like a lot of Trump's actions have just kind of shown how a lot of international law has no teeth to it. And it shows that, even you're talking about the jurisprudence, that I think Trump has realized that there are holes in the laws and holes in enforcement, both domestically and internationally, that even if he's not breaking them, he can kind of work around it to achieve his aims. And I think it's just a wake-up call that, while, the UN and these organizations are great and they do a lot of amazing things, there's more enforcement that I think needs to be needed if they want to achieve their goals.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that a lot of people are concerned about about all the sort of various developments is many of these executive orders would appear to, on some level, go against the sort of separation of powers within the Constitution and stuff. For example, the Congress has the power of the purse, which is to say they're the ones who have the power and authority to authorize spending. And part of the deal with that is that if they authorize spending, it actually is supposed to be spent. One of the things Trump is doing is sort of saying, well, I'm, with many of these orders is, we're not going to spend that money if we don't want to. And so the recourse would be to the courts. A lot of people feel, and we'll see how that goes, that even if he's blocked by the courts, will he actually follow those court rulings? And if he doesn't follow, who's to enforce it. Exactly. Because, of course, he controls all the executive branch sort of controls even more so now with the sort of the appointee of loyalists into head positions, you know, the enforcement agencies, you know, of the government. And as long as the Republican Party in Congress, in the two houses, is not going to do anything to oppose him, there's nothing what can happen.
Exactly.
One of the other things I think is interesting, as we've been watching over the last couple of weeks, you know, is just, you know, this the deterioration and of the transatlantic relationship, which has sort of been a sort of bulwark of, you know, the international order and American foreign policy since the end of the Second World War, with NATO and the close relationship with Europe. Trump is, you know, started to begin what he claims is a, you know, a peace process with Ukraine, but, you know, the first thing they do is talk to the aggressor, Russia, and leave out, you know, the Ukraine from that process. How do you get to, you know, peace without including all parties, and particularly, you know, ignoring, you know, the party that's been, is kind of the victim of the whole situation, mm-hmm. which is Ukraine. This has certainly got, you know, many in Europe alarmed, because, of course, not only are they concerned about the situation in Ukraine, but they're also really worried about the implications of an emboldened Russia to further threaten Europe. I mean, a number of the former Soviet East Bloc states are right there on the border, you know, the Baltic states and Poland and others, and they're pretty worried about it. One thing, you know, when Trump first came into office and started threatening the you know, the tariffs and talking the 51st state stuff, you know, one of my thoughts at the time, which people didn't talk about very much, is that, you know, doing that, you know, creates a situation, and I think a lot of Canadians feel this, where we can't trust the United States anymore.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that is key in the world of international relations, because there isn't some overarching authority that can enforce rules on the system, right? I mean, if you break a treaty, well, that's what happens. So the whole thing is sort of built on an a level of trust that we're going to make agreements, we're going to operate along certain rules, and under Trump, the United States is not doing that. They started that with Canada. We already have a trade agreement with the states that should set out the rules for how this trade relationship happens, one that was negotiated by Trump himself, and now he's sort of throwing that out the window. You know, now we look at what's happening in Europe, and with regard to Ukraine, but with regard to the relationship with you know, with Europe in general around security, and, you know, the United States is showing itself to not be a reliable partner. There is an article by a columnist in the Globe and Mail just about the relationship. Andrew Coyne, who's a conservative. He's not a, you know, he's a somewhat of a, you know, has a sort of right-wing position and is a conservative in this more the old school sense than what often passes for conservatism today. Mm-hmm. And he talked very strongly about the fact that, you know, we can't count on being able to work in an honest fashion with the United States anymore. You know, part of the sense of any negotiation is you make concessions on some issues, they make concessions on some issues, so that each party can get what they want, or at least something that comes to an agreement. But, you know, if we make concessions and then down the line those concessions aren't honored and more is demanded, how do you have a working relationship with that?
Yeah, it's definitely something I think is going to impact a lot of the state's position in the world. Like you said, since World War II, they've been this nation with a lot of power. But if other countries like Canada don't feel they can trust them, I think we're going to see a shift in, you know, who's the economic leader and who sets the social standards. And there's lots of other nations, I think, that would like to kind of have that title.
Mm-hmm. One of the things is, you know, one of the things that's given the United States a lot of power is that they're currency is sort of the reserve currency. Everybody saves their money in American dollars in American institutions, which also gives them a lot of power. You've talked about this before.
A little bit, yeah. Sometimes I talk about things that are a bit over my head. I do my best to... part of the thing that he talks about, this trade imbalance, is that we have a lower dollar. And this was something that I read... when I was talking about mainland China, and there was a paper from a professor of mainland China saying that they would like their currency to be more used worldwide. Yeah. Now, I actually have a few qualms about mainland China about how they treat their citizens, but so be it. That's what they brought up. So there is, I mean, would they rather have us having a higher dollar and they have the lower one and we have the trade imbalance in the United States? I mean, so it's silly. He's inventing things to be criticizing us for, because it's just about we have the lower dollar to the United States. That's why there's this supposed trade imbalance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things everybody seems to recognize about Trump is that every relationship for him is transactional. It's not really about building a trust relationship that where we can work together. It's like, what can I get out of this? You know, it's a zero-sum win-win game. Mm-hmm. And you were, you know, just a moment ago, you were sort of telling us about Trump's sort of typical business practices in the end, where he, you know, he makes some of the payments, and then when he's got the work done he wants, and he's got what he's got the work,
He
doesn't pay that last payment.
Mm-hmm.
Because he feels he doesn't have to. But that only works, you know, when you can keep moving on to new suppliers.
Oh, I like
right?
that.
Yeah.
Magnus, I'll just add something. The other thing about why the American dollar...
Okay, I just want to get my...
I'm sorry.
You can come back to this. But
there's a point I want to make.
The thing is, and the other thing I think it works about it is, of course, to a certain extent, you know, all those sort of relationships and transactionals in the business sense aren't really happening out in the open. I mean, they may not be hidden, but, you know, people aren't paying attention to everything someone does, right?
Yeah.
And so you can kind of, there's a bit of obscurity in that happening. In the international arena, you know, if you don't follow through in your agreements, everybody sees that, everybody knows that, and everybody knows going forward that you're not a party that can be trusted in an agreement. And I think one of the things for the United States is over the last 70 years, you know, they have been, I think for most countries, I know there's people who would say that in many places this hasn't been the case, but within their circle of their, of what you would call their partners on the world scale, they've been an honest broker, and you've been able to know what to expect and predict from them, and that's made them allow them to work effectively, and in many ways, you know, because they were the biggest player, you know, set the path for many international policy issues. The Americans say this is what we're doing, and everybody else goes, okay, well that's close enough to what we want to, so we'll go along with what you say. And I think we're going to see a lot less of that because, A, that divergence between what they want to do and what other people are doing is getting greater. And I'm not sure people are going to feel they can trust it. So, sorry.
What it is that, for example, with all OPEC countries, with the agreement was made in 1974, was that all OPEC countries can only accept American money for their petroleum. That is a deal which I think still exists now, even though there's been talk that Saudi Arabia wants to go off of it. And supposedly there are other commodities that have the same deal. See, this is kind of where the strength of the American dollar comes from, because you're forced into using it in those instances.
Yeah.
And there's been talk that maybe Saudi Arabia wants to end that deal. I thought that was something I remembered about that. So that's why the American dollar is king in many ways.
Well, it'd be interesting to get someone on the show to talk a bit more about how that works, because I brought it up a moment ago, and then as I started to talk about it, I realized, oh, it's a really complicated topic of how that reserve currency status gives Americans a lot of power, what it means in the international world, what it would mean to lose that potentially if that happens.
Well, they might actually.
Yeah, they might. But what does that mean? And it's like, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, what currency replaces that, right?
Yeah.
What
happens if there isn't a reserve currency that everyone sort of compared against? If they're all just floating around. Maybe, I don't know. Difficult. All right. Any last thoughts on this?
Well, that was sort of the idea of the BRICS nations.
Yeah.
And mainly about their commodities. Like, they have certain commodities. I don't know. I think that's just maybe an upset. We'll get more collaboration, Canada and Europe, or something. One thing is that but the tariffs are sort of based on, they have to be this emergency to implement it. So maybe he's just not going to implement it. I don't know. Anyway, but both of them have the caveat, there's a supposed emergency that needs to be done to bring them in.
All right. So, and when I say any last words about not just that one topic, but about what's going on, do you have any?
Yeah, I think overall, like we touched on this, but I think the common theme between all of the actions that we've been seeing coming out of the States is that this new administration is really sowing a lot of distrust, whether that's intentional or not. And I think overall, we're moving away from the globalized world that we've built into something that looks quite a bit different. And I don't know what that will look like, but I think it's going to be very interesting to follow these developments and see where it leads.
I don't think any of us knows quite how that's going to play out, because we haven't, you know, and we're not going to talk about this now, but, you know, we've been focusing on this relationship on one side, but China's sitting over there, you know. We haven't heard much from them, but I think they're looking, I'm sure that they're sitting there thinking, how can we take advantage of this?
Of course.
And things could be very different. So, Liam, you're going to be, this is your first time joining this show, but you're going to be working and putting together stories and stuff going forward. What sort of things are you interested in hoping to do coverage on?
I think for me, I really enjoy kind of local stories, especially when, you know, there's these big stories with real, like what we're talking about right now. They have such wide-reaching impact. So I think it's really interesting to kind of zoom in a bit and see how those are impacting people in our region in really personal ways. So that's kind of the general style I hope to take. Definitely with everything that's happening in politics, I think there's a lot of coverage there.
Great. Thanks. So that we'll be looking forward to hearing some of that from you in the coming weeks and months. All right. We have a story here from Jesse Wentzloth, and this is about a new exhibition of artist Kithyata Christian White. He's an Indigenous artist, and it's on now at the Bill Reed Gallery. So here is Jesse's report.
A new exhibition at the Bill Reed Gallery of Northwest Coast Art in Vancouver is celebrating the work of a master Haida artist and his outstanding contributions to his family, his community, and his culture. This is the featured artist, Kithyata Christian White.
Yeah, many of these pieces are inspired from stories that keep us tied to the lands and waters of our Haida Gwaii. And you can see the different techniques I've employed in my sculptures. It also shows the passing on of the knowledge and the culture to the next generation.
The retrospective exhibition, Kithyata Christian White, Master Haida Artist, spans the career of the renowned carver and multidisciplinary artist, ranging from stunningly detailed stone argillite sculptures and silver jewelry to cedar bentwood boxes and ceremonial masks.
It's a great feeling to be here in the Bill Reed Gallery and see all these pieces in the exhibition together. And, you know, it kind of shows the generations and the different decades, really, of my carving career, my art career. And also to kind of educate people that come here to see I think they could view our community, our Haida community from Haida Gwaii, you know, through a lens here and be able to see, you know, just like our different movements that we've started through the years, you know, the revival of our arts and culture, our ceremonies, our connection with the ancestors. Each one of the parts of the exhibit show that, really, and the value that we place upon our work, you know, that we have created over the years.
The unifying theme running through the entire exhibition is one of family and community, as the exhibit tells the story of Kiliata Christian White's unwavering commitment to uplifting members of his family and community through apprenticeships, the revival and renewal of traditional artistic and cultural practices, and the transformation of his own craft from a commercial endeavor to make ends meet into the center of an artistic community that preserves, shares, and pushes Haida art into the future.
My name is Amelia Ray. I am the assistant curator here at the Billery Gallery and the co-curator of this exhibition. This was really exciting and felt very natural. I grew up really closely with Christian's daughter. She's my best friend. And I grew up as a lead dancer in his dance group and spent a lot of time at his longhouse. So it kind of felt really right that we would put this on for him, and also like a lot of pressure because him and his family have just done so much for our community, so it felt really, it was a lot of pressure to be like, how can we honor him in the magnitude that he deserves. That was so important to us because that's how we know him, and you know, all of the collectors and people who know his work know him as an argillite carver and somebody who's selling in galleries, but to Haida Gwaii, he's the person who does so much for our community and for the preservation of our Haida culture. And so it felt really important that we honor that and reflect that in this exhibition, because he's, you know, you think of Christian White and he's so much more than just Christian White. He's his family and his dedication to our people. And he said something at one of his potlatches in 2022 that he's doing this out of the love for his people. And I think that we tried to reflect that the best way that we could.
While Kiliata Christian White has been sharing his culture with the world by creating and selling sculptures and other art since he was a youth, he eventually realized that through his art, he could build and strengthen his community in Haida Gwaii, preserving and revitalizing his people's traditional culture and heritage.
But midway through my career, I realized that we don't have to sell everything. We could keep what we want. We could keep things for our own use and our own culture. And so I found a way to do it. Something that wasn't really even heard of. We were encouraged, back in the day, we were just encouraged to sell everything, to burn everything, to move on. But in a way, it was our culture that kind of saved us. And saved my family. You know, we had nothing left. There was no fishing industry left. Logging was just devastating our islands. And so those weren't directions I wanted to go in. And so I was drawn to the arts. And now I encourage visitors to come to our islands. And what I encourage them to do is to take a picture, to go for a walk, to buy a piece of art, to support a living artist. So that's what I do, and I try to educate them.
This community-centric revitalization, helped by Kiliata Christian White's apprentices, has included a resurgence in the creation of one of the Haida's most iconic works.
You know, right now it's raising as many totem poles as we can on Haida Gwaii. There's a revival of that also. In 2017, I carved a totem pole. I had 8 apprentices, 4 female, 4 male. And then we carved a totem pole. It was standing as a tree December 1st or so, and then by June, it was standing as a totem pole. And I believe every one of those students really learned and gained a lot from that experience, as I did. And then I've seen a pole being raised in Haina, which is another ancient village. Another one was down in Kai'au or whatever, down in Windy Bay. So there's a revival of bringing totem poles back out onto the land, into the ancient village sites again. And so, you know, there was a big gap of 125 years of no totem poles being carved, and now it's been revived. And so there could be even a full-time carving in my community where I could have many apprentices, and I don't even have to do it all. We have other master carvers, journeymen that can carry it about. And so I think we've started that revival, really.
Beyond creating new works and preserving traditional techniques and methods, Kiliata Christian White's teachings build and strengthen community and provide his apprentices with structure, purpose, and sometimes a lifeline.
Like, I've probably kept a few people out of prison. So, or, you know, from going into that line, you know, if, you know, just getting in trouble. And so I've been able to